General Thompson, reel two.
Admiral Fieldhouse would rank northward. Under him, there would be three task group commanders. One was Admiral Woodward, who ran the carrier battle group, consisting of the two carriers plus escorts. The second was Commodore Clapp, who would command all the amphibious ships. And the third was myself, who commanded the landing force, consisting of my brigade, being reinforced by this time. There were disadvantages to this command setup. There was no joint force commander down south in the theatre of operations, which I believe was an error. What I think was required was a three-star admiral, i.e. a vice-admiral, who would, as it were, sit over the three group commanders down in the theatre, whereas the command structure, as it was designed, meant that we all three reported back up to northward, which, of course, in the end was 8,000 miles away. And it meant that they had to draw together the threads of the battle that was taking place 8,000 miles away. And this, I think, was incorrect.
How much intelligence at this stage did you have about the Argentinians themselves and their leadership?
Right. Well, at this stage, i.e. the 17th of April, we had very little intelligence. Some was starting to come in. But some of it was incorrect. For example, they got the leader, Menendez, wrong. There are several Menendezes in the Argentine army. And the chap they thought was the commander was a hard-hitting, tough guy who had a reputation in the Argentine army. Whereas, in fact, the Menendez that ended up commanding down there was not a particularly hard-hitting or particularly tough sort of chap. I think he'd been selected, I'm only guessing, to be the governor of the Falkland Islands. It was a fairly conciliatory sort of man. He wasn't the right sort of chap to have in there to command a battle, I didn't think. The intelligence picture got better as the days went past, and a lot of this was based on radio intercepts and so forth. So with that, we built up quite an accurate picture of where the Argentine army had deployed themselves. By accurate, I mean we knew that the 11th Regiment was in this sort of area on the island, but it didn't tell us exactly where they were or how they were equipped or where they were actually located company by company. And later, of course, we got some intelligence by using the SBS and the SAS, who were landed in certain parts of the Falkland Islands as required by Commodore Clapp and myself, and they were landed from the carriers which had gone forward, and we used to get through to the carrier battle group and say, please land a patrol in order to carry out the following task. We never said land them here to carry out the following task, because we left that to the discretion of those who had to do the landing of them. But they were able to provide some quite good information on what the enemy was doing and where they were and their state of training and morale and so forth.
How did you find the journalists aboard the ship? Did they cause any inconvenience or worries to you?
No. I mean, it was quite interesting because when we sailed, sometime before we got to Ascension, or some note wrong, after we got to Ascension, because most of the journalists came down in Canberra, there were some of them sailed with the other ships, but that was the first opportunity we got together with all the amphibious ships as Ascension. Colonel Clapp and I held a press conference on board Fearless, and that was the first time I'd met all the journalists, although I'd met one or two before. And they were a fairly disgruntled crew, I got the impression. The reason for that was that they perceived themselves as being the B team, or the second 11, because they perceived that the first 11, call it what you like, had gone ahead with the carriers. And they felt they were being cut out of the deal. And I was able to, I hope, reassure them slightly by saying, And I don't know if there's going to be a landing, but I can assure you that if there is, you'll be with us, and you'll land with units, and you'll be given the opportunity to really see what's going on. I suspect you'll actually see rather more of what's going on with people in the carrier battle group you'll see, which I hope managed to restore their humour a bit. And then I met some of them individually, particularly Robert Fox, I remember talking to, and I didn't find them any problems at all, quite frankly. I think that I was very lucky, because the chap I had, who I, as it were, put in charge of him as a minder, the chap called David Nichols, who was a Royal Marine major, or maybe a captain, who was a mountaineer of some note, and had also been a company man in the Dofar. So he had a sort of track record as a mountaineer, a track record as a soldier. And when he said things, they recognised that he knew what he was talking about. And this helped the credibility of things that were said, I think, and provided one quite frank with them, and provided you controlled what was being said from the sharp end rather than the blunt end, i.e. back in the mod, I think they accepted it. And certainly I never had any problems with it.
What else happened at Ascension?
Right, well, there were three tasks of Ascension. The first one was to do the restore, which I talked about. And that was actually not made easy by the fact there wasn't a port. So instead of being able to land everything and start again, which would have been the best thing, and had sort of queues of vehicles spreading miles back all over the island, we had to operate a sort of system of floating car parks using Mexifloats, which are, you know what I mean by Mexifloats, they're these long sort of rafts with two big outboard engines on the back, 120 foot long, and landing craft. Because in order to do the restore, you had to play a sort of Chinese puzzle game. Because in order to get a truck out of, say, the middle of one ship that you wanted to put into another, you had to take 10 trucks out of that ship, take off the one you wanted, put the other 10 back. But you had to put that 10 somewhere while you were taking the one out. So they were in this floating car park. And it was a very complicated game that my logisticians were playing, with, say, a Mexifloat full of trucks, all of which were eventually going to end up on different ships, and they had to keep a tally of where all these were. It was not made easier by the fact that there's actually a continual Atlantic swell, which, from a deck of a large ship, it doesn't look like anything, but it can be anything between 6 and 10 feet high, so your floating car park was going up and down like that all the time. That took up a lot of landing craft time and a lot of helicopter time as well. The second thing that we had to try and do was to combine some sort of amphibious training with some training ashore. Now, it was particularly important to do amphibious training for people like Three Parry, who had never seen a landing craft in their lives before. So you had to actually introduce them to this strange kit and teach them what the problems were with it. And also, we were working out of ships that we'd never worked out of before. Whereas my staff and I knew perfectly well how to offload an LPD or an LPH, because we'd done it many times in our lives. What we didn't know was how long it would take to take a whole battalion off Canberra and get it ashore by helicopter, for example. Canberra had two helicopter decks, which had been built on specially before she left England, each of which could take one helicopter. Instead of what we've been accustomed to, which is an LPA with 9 helicopters ranged on deck, all taking off together, here we were in a situation where you'd have 2 landing on, loading, going off, then 2, and then 2, and then 2, and then 2. So how long was that going to take to get 600 men off? We hadn't a clue how long it was going to take. How were we going to get men onto landing craft from Canberra? What routes had they got to use through the ship? So all these were things that had to be practiced and worked out and tried out. And this was not just in Canberra, but in any other merchant ship carrying troops. One had to, as it were, go through the system for doing it in order that come up with timings for how long it would actually take, because there's obviously no point in saying, okay, we'll land at that time, and then we'll land the next wave X hours later, if in fact it was going to be X plus 3 or 4 hours later, because of the sheer administrative business of getting men down through the ship, you know, out onto the landing craft and so on. So there was a lot of work that had to be done in that area. And then we did want to give everyone a leg stretch ashore to zero their rifles and fire their weapons. And that of course, there are no ranges in Ascension Island. But we were given a corner of the island, and then the chap who was the Pan Am manager, that was the airstrip, 11,000 feet long runway at Ascension, is actually administered by what was then Pan American on behalf of the American US Air Force. And he got lots of empty oil drums and suitable targets. And we had some very productive live firing at Ascension, where everybody was able to shoot all day and zero the weapons. And that also helped the sort of preparedness in people's minds, because, for example, the three power had anti-tank guns, and the allocation of HESH shells for a battalion is about 3 a year in normal peacetime circumstances. They can fire the inert shells, but they don't fire these very expensive HESH.
HESH?
HESH is the high explosive squash head. It's the real round that you use against a tank, as opposed to the inert, which hasn't got anything in it, which just hits and bounces off. And they get about 3 a year, which they use for demonstration purposes to show everybody how good it is. Now, something like 37 and a half years worth of HESH ammunition was fired off by three power in one day. So they were able to really get used to their weapons, and it made the boys realize that we were really serious, because we were allocating all this expensive ammunition to them, which in the past they'd never had a look at even. And I think it made them feel confident in their weapons and to recognize that we really were embarking on some serious project. So that was the second thing we had to do. And the third thing we were doing was my staffs were planning what we were going to do, in other words, where we were going to land, how we were going to land, and so on. And to help us in this, we were very lucky. We had someone you may have heard of called Major South Batalia, who had been in the Falklands a few years before and had occupied his time sailing round, apparently it wasn't sailing, motoring round in a motor craft, the islands, doing some examinations of the beaches and taking soundings, because the charts were about 1830-something. Though they'd been updated to the degree that they had, you know, reissued 1935, reissued 1940, whatever the figures were, if you go and see Ewan Sarpitelli and show them to you, they weren't actually updated. The surveys were something like 150 years old. And many of the soundings didn't go into close into the beaches, didn't show where all the kelp beds were. Now, he came up with, he's now written a book, or written a book some years ago, based on this. He had all those marked charts and all the notes for all these beaches on him, and he came down with me, and he was the only person who had these. So this enabled us to cut down the planning time enormously, because we could say, well, there's no point in looking at that beach, so it may have been a very, on at first sight, good place to land. It might have a reef there, which wasn't shown on the chart. And it's quite interesting, because this was shown, if you like, in reverse, because one of the places the Argentines reckoned we would land, we now know, was a place called Fowl Bay, which is just north of San Carlos. And obviously they'd never consulted their navy or looked at a chart, or the chart wouldn't have helped them, or done any proper soundings of it, because in fact there were extensive rock reefs right running out to sea from that bay. There's no way you could land there. But they thought that we might land there, because they'd just done a fairly cursory glance at an out-of-date chart and a map. And now we were able to dispense with the very time-consuming business of doing detailed surveys of the beaches, because they'd already been done for us. So that was the third thing that we were doing at Ascension.
And on the journey south, to what extent did you anticipate the possibility of, say, Argentinian attack by submarine or airstrike or something?
Well, we didn't think there'd be an Argentinian airstrike as far north as Ascension, because that's quite a long way from Argentina. And we're pretty sure they didn't have the capability to do it. One of the worries that the Navy had was submarines, because we knew the Argentines had some submarines, they had four. But curiously enough, the major threat perceived by the Navy was demolition divers landed by the Argentines in Ascension and swimming out and putting limpet mines on the ship. Because this thought, I think, had been put into their heads. And I'm not mocking them for thinking this. I think it's a perfectly reasonable thing to think. When an Argentine merchant ship came past Ascension and obviously did a big dogleg off her course to come past Ascension Island, and he could take a jolly good look at us. Now, I suspect it was just an ordinary Argentine merchant ship that happened to be coming from Europe, say, and heading towards Argentina, either out of curiosity or under instructions from Buenos Aires, had done this. And it then occurred to the Navy, what they could do is fly from to France or somewhere like that, as ordinary civilians, or to some country where they could get on board a ship, a merchant ship, which would then perhaps sail past Ascension Island, and they would then be dropped off in a boat and land on Ascension. In fact, there was a scare at one stage during the time of Ascension that they had done this, and I had to detach a company to go and search the top of the mountain, which is called the Green Mountain, because Ascension Island, though it's volcanic and totally bare, has its own ecosystem, because it has its own little cloud that sits over the top. So you have this sort of green cap sitting on the top, which is actually quite lush with vegetation and tropical sort of forest and that sort of thing. And we thought what they might do was land people on the other side of the island from where we were. They wouldn't walk up to the mountain where they could glimpse at us through their binoculars and discover what we were up to, and then perhaps come down the mountain with rubber boats or something. So what the Navy did to counter that was usually every night the whole lot set sail and steamed off into sea, because it was once a ship is steaming about a frog, one can't do anything about it, you can't catch up. This, of course, was another major disadvantage, because it meant you couldn't shorten the cross-decking time by loading at night, by doing it at night. And instead of being able to work 24 hours around the clock, the ship was steaming around. It also curtailed nighttime rehearsals. And there was never any place that we could do a full-scale rehearsal for the landing. This was A, because there weren't any beaches, except a very small one called English Bay, which would take one LCU at a time. And secondly, because you couldn't land the helicopters anywhere on the island except on the airfield, because of the dust. And if the dust was ingested into their engines, it would just totally screw up the engine. This very gritty, abrasive, volcanic dust. So you'd end up with no helicopters, all their engines would be completely messed up.
And on the voyage south from Ascension, what new problems did you have then?
On the voyage south, by this stage we realised that we were not going to have air superiority, which both Commodore Cap and I had been promised twice, that there would be air superiority before we attempted a landing, which was a normal requisite for an amphibious operation. We learnt bitter lessons in the past in places like Norway and Crete, as you didn't carry out operations near a place where the enemy had air superiority. And this worried us considerably. So we'd actually said, are we going to have air superiority? We'd asked it. We'd been told yes, twice. Now, we didn't expect the carriers to be able to get air superiority. We couldn't see how 22 Harriers, which is all they had, could gain air superiority over an Air Force who had 200 airplanes. What we, I suppose, thought was that there would be some kind of operations mounted on the Argentine airfield near the Falklands, which would take them out. And, of course, obviously that would have been politically unacceptable, but I suppose we still went on thinking it. And eventually it dawned on us that it wasn't going to happen. And this was confirmed when Admiral Woodward was by that time down south, and we were still at Ascension, sent a signal to Northwood, and I can't remember what it all said, but it expressed his concern that the air battle was not being won. It wasn't his fault, I must emphasize, it was not his fault. There was no way he'd win the air battle. A, because the Argentine Air Force wasn't coming out to fight, though they came out and attacked his ships. It was only small-scale raids. It wasn't the whole Air Force coming out. And secondly, they were also holding it back to see when the amphibious landing was going to take place. And in the bottom of the signal, I remember the words pretty clearly, they said something like, because of this inability to win the air battle, a ticket on a train about to leave Ascension is going to be very expensive. Now that, to me, meant we were going to take a lot of casualties. Now, it was not a signal that I showed around too widely, as you can imagine. It happened, we had an officer, because we were still at Ascension, visiting from Northwood. And I wrote a letter, which I sent back with him in his hand, saying, we will, of course, do exactly as we are told, but you should understand that if we don't get air superiority, we may have very heavy casualties before we even get ashore. And we got an answer back, which more or less said, don't worry. Well, of course, that was a rather silly answer, because we were worried. It would be much better to have said, we hear you, but you're not going to get air superiority, just get on with it, because that would have been a more honest answer, in my opinion. So that was Mike Clapp and I's big worry, was the air. There's no doubt about it, as we went south. And we were, I believe, exceedingly lucky. Because the Argentine Air Force, when they did attack, they couldn't attack on D-1 because we were lucky because we had a very thick fog as we did the run-in. And on the succeeding days, when the weather was good, they started off by attacking the wrong ships. They attacked the warships, which A, could fight back, and secondly, of course, to a degree, it didn't matter if they sunk warships. There were plenty more of those around. Had they sunk the logistic ships, particularly, and the troop ships, then we would have been in trouble in the early stages. So they went for the wrong ships, and that, again, I attribute to either bad tactics on their part or luck, and not something that one can say, well, aren't we clever? We've done it, if you see what I mean.
What other worries did you have apart from air superiority on the voyage south?
I didn't think I had any other worries than that. By that time, we'd been told where we were to land. And the way we'd done it was before we left Ascension, we had presented to Northwood, and we gave them to General Moore, who came out to visit us again just before we sailed, three options for landing. And the one we preferred was San Carlos. And we were then told six days after we left Ascension, that San Carlos it was to be, but the time and date were to be held, later, to be held in abeyance until we were told. And fortunately, we had done all the planning on the basis that San Carlos would be the one we were given. So the orders were all ready and based on that. So I was told on the 12th of April, it's to be San Carlos. So I was able to hold my orders group on the 13th, the day after, and tell them it's going to be San Carlos. The only thing I can't tell you is the date. So they were enabled then to start their briefing process on the 13th of April for a landing which eventually took place on the 21st. so they had plenty of time to brief their people.
How did you feel about General Moore not being ashore at first?
I would like to have seen him ashore. I mean, I wouldn't have wanted him to just sit on my shoulders and tell me what to do, because he would have only been command. You know, there'd only been one brigade there. But I think that, and he thinks, so I don't think I'm in any way stabbing him in the back or being dishonest or going behind his back. With hindsight, he believes that what he should have done, instead of sailing down in QE2, which he did, he joined her at Ascension, and then sailed down, was then out of communications with me in the course of 10 days. He should have probably tried to join the amphibious task group by parachuting into the sea, and then perhaps set up on board HMS Intrepid with a small staff, and really just acted in a monitoring capacity. I don't think, knowing him, he would not have interfered, which would have made life much easier, because what happened, you see, was on D-1, the 20th of May, was when he joined QE2 in Ascension. The command chain was changed so that I was no longer directly under Northwood, but he interposed himself between me and Northwood with 5 Brigade. So if you like, instead of having a command chain that started with Double Fieldhouse, and then you had Woodward, Clapp and Thompson as sort of little hanging off the bottom of the tree, I then moved down a place, and he came in between me and Northwood with 5 Brigade sitting alongside me. Now the trouble was, of course, that meant that he became the action addressee on signals, and I became the information addressee on signals from Northwood. I assumed that what it said in the signal was what I had to do, but I wasn't able to discuss it with my boss, i.e. General Moore. I didn't know whether what I was being told to do fitted in with what he wanted. I couldn't discuss it with him, because there were no communications. I didn't even know that he wasn't getting the signals from Northwood, so he was in a total vacuum.